All right, so here with John, we're talking about Bill C-9. So obviously Bill C-9 has gotten a lot of attention in the last couple of weeks. Some of it good, some of it bad, some of it seemingly a little over the top even. What's your assessment in terms of, you know, splitting the fact from the fiction here? What's Bill C-9 about, and why are Christians so upset about it?
Yeah, we started actually with a brief and a committee appearance on Bill C-9 as it was. And then, of course, the removing the religious defense to hate speech kind of became, understandably, the main focus of conversation. But yeah, let's start with what C-9 does, what it was supposed to do, right? One, it was going to, I guess some background. So with the October 7 attacks, Israel's subsequent military campaign against Hamas, that was giving rise to, in Canada, obviously pro-Palestinian demonstrations, but more than that, a lot of anti-Jewish criminal activity, even right, vandalizing Jewish facilities, synagogues, and so on. So that's been a major concern and something that the government says C-9 is supposed to help address. I'm pretty skeptical that it would actually do so. In terms of what C-9 does in protecting religious facilities and access to those, the law already does. So that's one thing it was supposed to do, was kind of clarify the law on protecting access to religious and community facilities.
Bill C-9 is sort of a later rendition of something the Trudeau government was already trying to bring into place, wasn't it? Like, they had been talking about hate speech legislation already before the October 7th situation. So this is sort of a continuation of that conversation, but you're suggesting they've taken it in a different direction, or has that become kind of the focus of the C-9 conversation?
Yeah, so that's one part of it, but you're right. This does precede that. So Bill C-63, yeah, as people recall, that was more general, kind of, it was creating a freestanding hate crime. Forget hate speech for a second. That's another thing that Bill C-9 still does, but it's a little bit different in terms of how the sentencing works, but it still creates a standalone hate crime. So any crime, anything in the criminal code that someone does that the court finds is motivated by hatred, you can have an additional charge laid on you, right, of committing a hate crime, and then that can bring with it an additional sentence. It can effectively double your sentence. So before, in C-63, it could bring a life sentence. So imagine someone stole something and then it was motivated by hatred, that could carry up to life imprisonment. Now it kind of mirrors the offense that it's paired with, effectively, potentially roughly doubling your sentence. So that's another thing
so
that C-9 still does.
Is that better than it was before? Like, in this,
it's toned down, but okay. It's still I think raises some civil liberties concerns. Yeah. Now, I mean,
but just to clarify on that point, though, so what you're suggesting is that if, let's say, somebody were to cause damage to a synagogue or something like that, right, there's obviously a vandalism charge that goes up against that. But you're suggesting they would then, if that person, it wasn't just a vandalism charge, they would, if it was motivated by hate, there would be an additional up to lifetime sentence previous to this?
That was C-63.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. C-9 still does this. Like, it says, okay, on top of that, you can have a hate crime charged against you, but now the sentencing will be, you know, if it's the mischief or damage to property, that sentence plus, let's say that's up to 5 years or up to 10 years, okay, you can tack on another 10 years for the freestanding hate crime. Now, interestingly, we already have, you know, the mischief to property. Yeah. If it's against religious property, it's already a higher sentence. That's already in our criminal code right now. Okay. As well as an offense motivated by hatred, that's a factor in sentencing. So it still means the range of penalties for that offense still applies, but if it was found to be motivated by hatred, a judge is supposed to lean towards probably a heavier sentence, yeah, okay, right? Again, C-9 is obviously taking that up a notch by saying this is another crime you're charged with that kind of goes on your criminal record of you've committed a hate crime.
Okay. So then, I mean, I guess the qualifier to this, obviously, is that as Christians, we understand the fact that the Bible does speak out against wrongful speech, right? There are limitations in terms of what, as Christians, we ought to say, or, you know, what people in general ought to say to each other, right? There's obviously the commandments against slander, commandments against, lying and all those kinds of things. So it's not that speech has no limitations, right? I think there's this misunderstanding potentially that free speech in and of itself is a Christian idea. There are limitations on what you can and ought to say, right? Just maybe frame it from a biblical context in that sense of like, speech doesn't have absolutely no limitations either. And so what's the role of government in that, I guess?
Maybe yeah. That's the question. We didn't even touch on this last part that C9 does, which is to define hatred in the law as it applies to the offense of willfully promoting hatred.
Okay.
Right. So that offense is already in our law. It's been in our law since, I think, 1970. And that basically, it's a bit of a tricky one, because in other countries, it can mean a lot of things. In Canada, our courts have tried to read it fairly narrowly to mean something like extreme group defamation, right? If you take a group of persons, whether that's defined by religion or something else, there's been examples in our case law, so I'll just use those real life examples, of someone saying, you know, all Muslims are terrorists or support terrorism. Okay. I mean, that's false, right? It's for Muslims, you know, living here. If someone's spreading that and people are believing it, it's not likely to make their lives pleasant and so on. So that's committing false testimony against your neighbor, you could say, from a Christian perspective, even if you're not naming a particular person, right? All homosexuals are pedophiles. That's another example that's come up in the case law. Again, that's a kind of group defamation, and one that's, you could say, designed to rile people up and fear that group and vilify them and maybe even harm them, right? Although, again, advocating violence against a group is that's covered in other offenses. Promoting hatred is actually considerably broader, right? And that's why it has these defenses that don't appear in other offenses. So if you're advocating genocide or counseling terrorism or things like this, there are no defenses to those, right? But when you're promoting hatred, again, potentially a kind of unwieldy and broad offense, there's four defenses to that. I think those defenses are designed to make sure that it doesn't kind of get out of hand. It isn't interpreted in a way that censors speech unduly. But you're right. I mean, if we try to think about this as Christians, we obviously have free speech concerns. People consider much of the Bible hateful insofar as it condemns choices, lifestyles that our society today approves or even celebrates, right? But when you consider the examples I gave of basically defaming a group in kind of a gross and severe way, that's a wrong. It's a wrong that can affect people's lives.
In terms of this definition of hatred then, so is this, based on what I'm reading in the legislation, this is sort of the Justice Department's summary of what the bill would say, so maybe this isn't exactly what it does say, but it would create a definition of hatred for two of the existing hate propaganda offenses, and it says the definition would specify that hatred involves detestation or vilification and not disdain or dislike. What's that about?
That's trying to draw on the case law that defines hatred. So just think about it. What does it mean that it's a crime? We know what assault is. We understand these other offenses. What does it mean that you're promoting hatred? If I gave it some fairly clear-cut examples of like you're clearly defaming someone in a kind of extreme way. But it's potentially much broader than that because it doesn't say defaming or libeling. It says promoting hatred against a group. And so our court took the approach of saying, well, okay, hatred is a feeling, it's an emotion. Let's define it as an extreme emotion, right? And then that way, that should narrow the scope of the law. And the Supreme Court actually narrowly upheld the law. It was challenged as unconstitutional in a 1980s case. It was decided by the Supreme Court in 1990 called Keekstra. And the court decided 4-3 to uphold the law. But to do so, it said, let's make sure it's fairly narrow. So hatred was just defined as partly what you said there, an emotion that involves detestation or vilification. Those are supposed to be terms that suggest that it's a very extreme emotion. But the court has said a lot more. So in the law, right, in our written law, it's not defined. It's defined in case law. Okay. And the courts say more things like it's an extreme emotion that belies reason, and you could pick more phrases. But what the bill does here is to basically cherry pick a couple things, put it in the bill, and then say, there, we've actually clarified, we've defined in law what hatred means. And that might seem to be fine. That actually might even seem to be a good thing, because, you know, precedents can change and what have you. But I think and I think actually there's a pretty strong argument to be made that the existing case law sets a higher standard than what would be reflected in the definition that C9 would place into law if it's passed. Mm-hmm. But even I think that, like, that whether this definition just kind of reflects the case law and that's all it's supposed to do, just kind of a short version of the case law, or actually lowers the bar, that concern is almost less to me. It's a less of a concern now than the removal of the religious defense.
Mm-hmm. So maybe let's switch gears to that a little bit, explain kind of what's going on with that amendment. So obviously on December 9th, I believe it was, the Bloc and Liberals joined together to support an amendment to the legislation that would remove that good faith provision for religious statements, right? What does that mean? What was that exception supposed to cover for, and why is it a concern now?
The defense is that if you've, so assuming that at least on the face of it, you have met the bar of you're promoting hatred against a group, you can plead several defenses, right? One is that what you said is true. Another is that you were making a religious argument or stating a religious opinion, right? Or interpreting a religious text, right? So it's an opinion on a religious matter or a religious text. And there's a couple others about matters that are important and in the public interest to discuss, and you believed what you were saying about them was true, even if it wasn't in fact true. The fourth is you were identifying matters of hate. You're actually trying to combat something hateful. You weren't trying to actually reinforce or endorse what you were saying. You were trying to actually condemn it.
Kind of like what you were doing earlier in this.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. The religious defense, that's the one that they're now cutting. It's something the Bloc has proposed to do before, and the Bloc has been explicit that they think that the religious defense opens basically too much room for homophobic statements, anti-Semitic statements as well. They kept referring to an example of an imam who actually arguably was counseling terrorism or advocating genocide. Again, things that don't
this
have
is in
defenses.
Montreal, right?
That's right.
Yeah. And the Bloc have sort of defended the traditional Quebec position on some of this stuff, which is, you know, Quebec is sort of the most secular province in the country, potentially. They have this sort of religious symbols legislation that they use the notwithstanding clause for. So this is a bit of a tradition there in terms of politicians from Quebec trying to push more for these kinds of secular arguments, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think any, you know, there's humanist associations, they see it as any kind of special treatment for right. religion as, well, that's not fair. You shouldn't be able to hide behind religion to promote hatred. Yeah. Now, again, it's a good faith religious defense. So it has to be found that you actually are sincerely trying to make an argument about a religious belief, right? That's what the defense says. It's actually never been successfully used. There's been a couple of cases where Christians actually have tried to use it after saying some bad things about Muslims. Most of which, I think, what they're saying doesn't really necessarily connect to, okay, well, here's I can draw on the Bible to say those things, especially when those things are false. Mm-hmm. But where the work that it does is really in preventing charges from being brought that shouldn't be brought, right? Because a prosecutor has to think, okay, the accused can use that defense, right? So
what's the chance of success of my...
That's right. And by the way, I mean, hate propaganda charges are very rarely brought to begin with, right? They require attorney general consent. And the bar has been pretty high for conviction. So there are a number of convictions, but these cases are rare.
Okay. So the concerns obviously around that amendment have, I think it's fair to say, have been blown a little bit out of proportion. To the point of, you know, certain members of parliament tweeting that the Bible is going to be banned, and you can't read scripture in church, and you know, they even going to the point of propping up a Bible in front of the podium at the Justice Committee and stuff like this, right? Like there's a certain certainly a political benefit potentially to making this a bigger thing than it is. That's not to say it isn't a big thing, but I think the issue is really finding the nuance of, okay, what does this actually mean practically? And so maybe you can answer that question in terms of for churches or for individuals, what does this mean practically for them in terms of their ability to preach the gospel, or for an evangelist to go out and speak on the streets, those kinds of things? Does this impact that?
Yeah, I think it potentially does. So for one, no, it doesn't mean that, you know, the Bible or certain Bible passages can't be read, can't be posted online or something like that. But it's all about how you use it, right? So there's a case of Päivi Räsänen is a Finnish MP, and she was charged essentially under that country's hate speech laws when she posted an image of Romans 1 on social media. But more than that, she commented that so there was the Lutheran Church had sponsored a pride event, and she said something like, "This is a matter of sin and shame, not pride," and posted Romans 1. And she was also charged for other reasons. She had written a short booklet defending traditional marriage and so on. So if you see something like that, it depends kind of how you use it and the context in which you use it. So it doesn't mean that, oh, you can cite and use the Bible for anything you want or say anything you want still based on what the Bible teaches, right? There is, in my mind, a concern, and we see this in other countries, that a speech that is considered homophobic, where you don't have a religious defense to fall back on, right, means you're more at risk of, first of all, prosecution and obviously conviction. Now, Päivi Räsänen has not been convicted. Her case has been appealed. She won twice. Her case has been appealed twice. And the European laws, religious and free speech defenses have worked in her favor, okay, right? But again, even having to go through years of criminal litigation and defend yourself, that's a major...
Punishment enough, right?
That's right. That's right. So...
So I guess that's some of the concern maybe that's in informing the conversation right now on social media, and that is seeing some of those things taking place in Europe, seeing some of that happening in the UK, where, you know, you get these social media posts of police knocking on doors because of something somebody posted on Facebook and things like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
What chance is there that that's a result of this kind of legislation here in Canada? Is that a realistic thing, or is it more dependent on kind of how laws like this are applied practically after they've passed, or?
Yeah, I mean, some of what we hear about going on in the UK, for example, I think results from police decisions to investigate hate incidents, even if they don't amount to hate crimes, so for the police to kind of create a record of these things. And so there's some ways that it's just, these have been bad policing rules, even if people aren't getting criminally charged. In the end, they're
being scared potentially.
Yeah, that's right. But I mean, I use the example of Päivi Räsänen. There's other international examples we could go with. But I was going to say closer to home, but literally at home in this country, you can see examples from the human rights law context. So the way that courts have defined hatred in the criminal law is the same as they define it in human rights law. So there are certain provinces, mainly the Western provinces, that have promoting hatred provisions in their human rights code, right? And that's obviously not a criminal offense, but someone can bring a complaint and you could have to, you know, if the tribunal finds you on a balance of probabilities, right? So not proof beyond a reasonable doubt, but balance of probabilities, guilty of hate speech, you can have to pay compensation to a person or a representative group or what have you. And again, Whatcott, who's been in court a lot, in a BC case, was distributing pamphlets about an NDP candidate who's a transgender, who is a man who's identifying publicly as a woman. And basically this pamphlet said, this person's lying to you, the media is lying to you, they're all on board to promote a kind of transvestite lifestyle, which is unhealthy and it's a lie, the Bible's clear, God made them male and female, right? And in that case, he lost, and the tribunal, in responding to his point that, well, this is my religious view about the morality of identifying as transgender, of lying about your identity and so on, the tribunal basically said there's no difference between what you claim to be stating your Christian view and promoting hatred, right? There's no difference. Like basically in the end of the day, I don't care. This is how your Christian belief shakes out on this. That view is hateful. And in the provincial law context, there is no religious defense, right? The justice minister has responded to concerns and said, look, don't worry, folks. The charter protects religious freedom anyway. Nothing to worry about here. Even with this, without this defense, the charter's got you. You have enough protection there. But that's, the charter is working in the background of all laws, right? That's true of the provincial law as well. But it didn't stop Whatcott from losing his case and having to pay tens of thousands of dollars in that case for an a pamphlet that was criticizing a transgender candidate and transgender ideology broadly, from facing penalties in that case. And the tribunal seemed quite certain of that. It wasn't just the balance of probabilities thing. It seemed like in another context, you can imagine that being, well, that's beyond a reasonable doubt. This is what this guy wanted to do. He wanted to promote hatred against transgender persons. So I find that quite striking, the justice minister saying, well, don't worry about it. You can fall back on religious freedom. I mean, you could cut the rest of the defenses as well and say, don't worry, just fall back on free speech, right? Courts can't say, well, because of religious freedom, we're going to read in our own defenses, right? A court's going to look at Parliament removed this defense. That means Parliament wants the court to draw a different balance between religious freedom and freedom of expression and preventing the spread of hatred, mm-hmm. right, or hate promoting ideas or what have you. So that's the concern.
The fundamental difference, I think, between those two, between what you're talking about with the tribunals, which is a provincial level, is that's not a criminal conviction then, right? So what we're talking about here is actually, so when there's sort of these human rights tribunals at the provincial level, all they can do is fine them or something like that. But what we're talking about here is the federal criminal code, which covers the entire country and applies to the actual justice system, the courts, the police, which is at a kind of a different level than the human rights tribunals as well, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Criminal record, potential prison time, and with this freestanding, we talked earlier about the freestanding hate crime, right? That's potentially doubling the sentence. Yep. That seems like a strange one, right? It's like, well, of course, when is hate speech not going to be a hate crime, right? You're going to be convicted of both. They're effectively potentially lowering the bar for what counts as hate speech, removing the religious defense, and jacking up the sentencing, mm-hmm. the penalties. So
it's interesting too. You point out the fact that the justice minister seems to be trying to sort of cover all his bases, because even in this paper that I printed off from the Justice website, which is their statement about it and charter considerations, they go through that all before they even address anything that's in the bill. They say, here's the charter considerations that are engaged by this bill potentially, but here's how, you know, we avoid that with freedom of religion, freedom of expression, etc., before they even get into the details of the bill. So they're aware this is going to be controversial in Canada.
Right.
So in terms of next steps, obviously this bill is still going through the House of Commons. It's still at the Justice Committee. That's going to be happening in February, likely, because the House has now risen for the Christmas period. They don't come back until January 26, where they'll then come back and start considering the bill. Then it goes to the House of Commons for a third reading and then final vote, which could be February, March. Then it goes to the Senate. You know, so we're talking several months yet before we'd see royal assent to a bill like this. That gives us opportunity to engage with it, right? And mm-hmm. We have an easy mail that's available, which we'll link in the show notes below, that people can send to their member of parliament into the new year as well. Any other thoughts on that in terms of timeline or kind of what people can do to engage with this?
Yeah, it's hard to know exactly when it will get to back to the House, but I'd say while we have time, it's very good to engage. We actually, I was telling Daniel this earlier, got an email from a Coptic Orthodox a priest who was saying, you know, I saw ARPA's work on this. What can we do to help? What can our network do to help? Mm-hmm. I just encouraged him to, you know, also, it's going to require some pushback from the Liberal caucus, you know, officially the Liberal Party's position is on board with the bloc on this. And like Bill C-218, different issue, right, euthanasia, mental illness, it's going to take some pushback from within the Liberal Party. So I'd say especially for folks in, you know, in Liberal ridings, you know, don't just write to your MP, call them, even try to meet with them, reach out to religious leaders. For those who are a religious leader, you know, reach out to fellow religious leaders from different denominations and backgrounds. And it's important to push while we still have time. Mm-hmm.
Interesting, maybe just as a quick aside in terms of the political situation. So obviously Mark Carney is a Catholic or professing Catholic. But we had this interesting thing. I think you noted that to me a couple days ago, that the Catholic bishops had written to him as prime minister about this bill. And now that, you know, even though there seems to be a bit of a kerfuffle around, oh, did the minister actually consult with Mark Carney about this amendment and making this deal with the bloc? And there was a bit of back and forth about, like, okay, is Mark going to, you know, Mark Carney going to come in and say this didn't have my authority, and so we're going to actually retract the support for the amendment? But none of that happened. They did end up supporting it. But you were saying that potentially the issue is that for him to look like he's listening to a letter from Catholic bishops could be potentially problematic for him politically, right?
I think so. If you imagine, think about, you know, the Liberal Party and Liberal Party politics. If that's the perception, is the Catholic bishops wrote a letter and the Prime Minister, you know, got his Justice Minister in line, I don't think it's going to go over well with his cabinet or his caucus at all, or his strategist or anyone. So that was, you know, I think it's going to take a lot more, you know, community and constituent pushback, than just a letter from. I'm glad the Catholic bishops wrote it. I really appreciate that. But it's going to take a lot more community engagement on it.
All right, more to come. Thanks very much.
Thank you.